Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to another edition of The Big Picture. I am AB Dawji in the new time slot of Saturday morning, right up until 12 o'clock, inshallah. And it's so good to be speaking to you on a Saturday morning. Friday is a bit hectic, eh? I gotta wake up early and make the dal and rice and soji and papar, fried fish and fried brinjal and fried peppers and the gajar achar and ish. Too hectic. So now I'm much more relaxed. And as usual, we look at the crazy stories that made it into the media. But first, a question. What is the similarity between South Africa and Zimbabwe? And the answer is that in Zimbabwe, the president wants his wife to be the next president. And in South Africa, the president wants his ex-wife to become president. Yakuba is backing Nkosazana in the race, but the outcome is not very certain. But in Zimbabwe, Mugabe's wife, Disgrace Mugabe, has a pretty good chance of making it to the top. And that is because she got the deputy president, Emmerson Mnangagwa. What's his name now? Let's see. Mnangagwa. She got him booted out. She made a fiery speech at a Women's League meeting, accusing Emmerson of planning a coup against Mugabe. And also, she ended her speech by saying that a woman should also be given the opportunity to be the deputy or even the president of the country, meaning, of course, herself. And so, what Disgrace wants, Disgrace gets. Next day, Mugabe fired Emmerson, and the ZANU-PF Youth League declared that they want her, Grace Mugabe, to be the president. And so, as they say, it's all cut and dried. One may describe Grace Mugabe as the chief whip of her party. I think her 93-year-old husband has no chance of standing up to this shambok auntie. Remember how she whipped her two sons when she found them in a Santon hotel in a room with some young ladies? And the young ladies also caught it with an extension cable. One of them had to get some stitches to her head, and Disgrace quietly escaped back to Zimbabwe before the cops caught up with her. But her boys like the good life. Who said that Zimbabwe is struggling? Who says that its currency is going down the drain or was in the drain a long time ago? That, dear listeners, is fake news. It's all lies, I tell you. Grace Mugabe's son, Gorerasa Russell, her son from her first marriage, recently he bought two cars. Nothing too fancy. Nah, nothing good. Just two Rolls Royces worth around, let's see, 75 million rands. Ah, that's not a big deal. I'm sure that the starving masses in Zimbabwe must be so happy that the First Lady's son is moving around in comfort and safety. And her two sons from Robert Mugabe are also doing very well. Thank you. I saw some great photographs and videos of them, the two brothers, Chatunga and Robert Jr. And they were again at a Santon nightclub. Chatunga uploaded a video of himself on Snapchat. He was wearing a big, fancy watch. It's all on the website of the British newspaper, the Daily Mail. You can go and see it there. And there you will see the watch. How much is the watch? Well, just a small little amount of £45,000. And that's about, let's see, when I looked at the rand the last time, and it's dropping very fast. The cost of the watch is 853,000 rands. And he was bragging that he got the watch because, in his words, Daddy runs the whole country. And then in the video you see him pouring, believe it or not, two bottles of champagne over the watch. 2 bottles of champagne. The champagne is called Armand de Brignac. Armand de Brignac, Ace of Spades Gold. That's the full title of it. And the price of a bottle of Armand de Brignac, Ace of Spades Gold, how much? £200. That is 3,792 rands and 59 cents. See, I've done my homework, right? So each bottle of champagne worth about 4 grands each was poured over the watch worth around 800 grand. My question is, why would they do that? To impress the girls they were with? Could that be the reason? Maybe they were just making some sort of a metaphorical statement that they had time to kill. Something like that. Maybe that's the message they want to get out. They have time to kill. My view is that these morons should be given some lekker chutney with a shambok and chased back to Zimbabwe, where 3/4 of the population lives below the poverty line. Okay, now to the next story. And this from the Huffington Post. And it happened in Florida, in the good old US of A. Let me say this. Drinking alcohol is a bad thing. No doubt about it. Drinking alcohol is a bad thing. But what's worse is driving while under the influence of liquor. And then you go and kill someone, have an accident, smash into somebody. And so 53-year-old Donna Byrne was arrested for being drunk while making her way over a very busy road. What was the charge? No, it wasn't drunken driving. It was drunken riding. That's right, she was riding a horse. Here's what the report says. Donna Byrne appeared confused and smelled strongly of alcohol when Polk County Sheriff's Office deputies pulled her over on a busy Lakeland Road just after 1:30 p.m. She was found to be more than twice the legal breath alcohol limit for driving. And Sheriff Grady Judd said, Miss Byrne was obviously not in any condition to be on the road. She not only put herself and the horse in danger, but also anyone who was driving out the road, which is typically very busy. Police charged Byrne with driving under the influence and animal neglect. Cops transported a horse named Beau Duke to Polk County Sheriff's Animal Control Livestock Facility. Beau Duke. Well, they locked Beau Duke for this auntie here. Well, I suppose you won't find a bigger mampara than this pitak. And here's a story that really got me laughing. But first, let me express a view about the latest smartphones. Okay? The latest smartphones. It never ceases to amaze me how every new model that comes out is even more jam-packed with new technology that is just mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. Remember how thrilled we were to own those early cell phones, the Nokia 2110 or 2010, that brick with an aerial? Well, it could make calls and you could send SMSs, if I remember correctly. How sophisticated we felt then, eh? When we whipped out one of these Nokias and made a call. Felt so advanced. Much to the envy of those who didn't have one. Today, the cell phone is a mini computer, doing everything. Making calls, sending SMSs, social media, WhatsApp, powerful cameras, transferring pictures and videos to dozens of people all at once. You can type document, everything. But a feature most people look for these days is privacy. You don't want anyone to look into your phone without your permission, especially your husband or wife. You never know what shocking stuff they may discover there. It could capsize your whole world. So, locking the phone is vital, and only you can unlock it. At first it was, they had this new system where you make some zigzag pattern on the front of the phone, on the opening page. You know what I'm talking about. But recently, the fingerprint reader is the latest thing in all the phones, in all the latest phones. So, previously, you may be able to guess the zigzag pattern on your hubby's phone, but now only his fingerprint on the phone's fingerprint reader can unlock the phone. And so let's look at Qatar Airways flight QR962 taking off from Dubai, from Doha in Qatar. Well, it was flying from Doha to Bali in Indonesia. On board was an Iranian couple and their child. They were going on for a holiday in Bali. The plane was flying over India at that point. The husband was snoring one way. His phone was lying on his lap. The wife looked at the phone. Then she picked it up. It was locked. She very carefully took her husband's thumb and placed it on the fingerprint reader, and the phone unlocked. And then all hell broke loose. Total chaos. The woman saw messages on the phone which showed that this O was catching a jol with some other woman. Whoa, khalas. She saw red, blue, green, all colors. And she started screaming and clapping him. I can just imagine. He was snoring and suddenly collecting some nice hot ones there. The air hostesses couldn't stop her. She went crazy giving him lucker tight ones, left, right and center, while screaming at the top of her voice, totally out of control. Let me read from the British Guardian newspaper from yesterday. The captain was forced to make an unscheduled stop in Chennai in India when the cabin crew was unable to restore order. The family was then taken to a detention center at the airport as they did not have an Indian visa. The family spent the day at Chennai airport and left for Malaysia on a Batik Air flight at 10:30 p.m. Sure! I can't imagine what kind of holiday they must be having. In Bali, this Bali must be collecting some hot kicks and blows. I'm sure that some characters who are listening to this out there today, now, some characters who are listening to this must be getting quite nervous. Thinks, I have to put some sellotape around my thumb when I am sitting on the sofa this afternoon while watching the match, just in case I fall off to sleep. The fro is in the kitchen acting like she's not paying attention to what Ebi Dauji is speaking about, how the bully got caught out with his fingerprint. Well, there you are, folks. This auntie on the Qatar flight demonstrates once again that women are very clever indeed, smarter than any smartphone. Now to another story. There's going to be a big meeting that's going to take place in the city of Hyderabad in India on the 28th of November. It's called the 2017 Global Entrepreneurship Summit, which is an annual meeting of investors and people starting new businesses, which this year, according to the Guardian newspaper, is focused on the theme Empowering Women. As I said, this year it's being held in Hyderabad in just 2 weeks' time. And so, in preparation for this big event, the city is conducting a cleaning up operation. By cleaning up, I mean, according to the article, manholes are being replaced and manhole covers are being replaced, roads are being repaired and buildings and signs repainted and so on. Very nice, very nice. Making everything nice and clean for all the guests coming into town. But the main cleanup is the removal of the beggars. Let me read to you from the article. Nearly 400 people in the southern Indian city were detained by police on Wednesday and lodged in a rehabilitation facility at Chang Chal Guda jail, according to the Indian Express. What kind of rehabilitation facility? It's a jail. About 6,000 people are expected to be taken to such facilities in the next week or two. An unnamed officer told the Indian Express that some homeless people were objecting to be ushered out of sight. Some, he says, some beggars argue that we were taking their freedom to live any way they want. But we told them it was for their own good because they are going to the rehab center where they will be taken care of. Hey, to speak like that, I had to shake my head a little bit from left to right. The city's police commissioner, Mahandar Reddy, said in a notice that it had come to his attention that people were begging alms in an indecent manner. They are also employing children and handicapped persons to solicit or receive alms at the main junctions of the road. Such acts are causing annoyance and awkwardness. Oh. Hey, Laddu, what are you talking about? Throughout the whole of India, there are such beggars. So why now suddenly you say that such acts are causing annoyance and awkwardness? Who exactly will feel annoyance and awkwardness? Dear listeners, here is the answer to the question, who exactly will feel annoyance or awkwardness? All this frantic cleanup, fixing roads, locking up beggars, is being done to present a nice clean view of the city to a very, very important delegate to the conference. And who would that be? Who is this important guest? No, you'll never guess. You won't guess. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together to welcome for the 2017 Global Entrepreneurship Summit in Hyderabad, the daughter of the President of the United States, Ivanka Trump. Yes, folks, President Pagla's daughter will be the guest of honor, the highlight. And as the Guardian says, her attendance is a diplomatic boon for India and has been trumpeted by the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in several tweets. India has been trying to ensure the bilateral relationship that burgeoned under George W. Bush and Barack Obama continues under Donald Trump. The country is an eager customer for U.S. weapons and military equipment. The begging ban will remain in place until January. So, Narendra Bhai is so excited, eh? And when Ivanka is being driven through Hyderabad, no one will be knocking at a window showing a deformed arm or a baby with a disfigured face and cry, "Paisa de de, madam, paisa de de." All that is being swept away with a nice big broom. But hang on, I got one more quick story for you in this loony section. Dear people, you know, times are very hard. People are battling. Prices are rising. Shoo! Have you seen the price of butter recently? And my Roxana makes me very happy by cooking in artery-clogging ghee. And the price of a tub is sky high. One may say that the cost of dying is going up. So, dear listeners, as I said, people's stress levels are going up dramatically. So, to deal with this, a group of scientists are here in South Africa investigating stress levels. Whose stress levels are they checking? Black people? Whites? Browns? No. These scientists are investigating the stress levels of zebras. You heard right. Zebras. Here is what a scientific newspaper had to report. It says here, the research found that zebras are facing multiple challenges, including poor habitat and gender imbalances, which are likely to compromise their health, have repercussions for their reproduction, and ultimately a population's long-term survival. Whew. Amazing, isn't it? Eh? Hundreds of thousands of rands are being spent to measure the stress level in zebras. I am so impressed, and so impressed. And here is the best part. How do they find out if a zebra is stressed? How do they find out if a zebra is stressed? They examine the zebra's poo. No, I'm not kidding. Apparently, the more a zebra is stressed, the more it releases a particular chemical, a hormone, into its bloodstream, and this comes out in its dung. So the scientists measure this hormones to see how stressed is the zebra. And Dr. Suzanne Schultz, the senior author from the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Manchester, explains, "Fecal hormone measurements are easy to collect without disturbing the animals and provide a window into the chronic stress animals are experiencing. Using these indicators, we can establish the health of both individuals and zebra populations." Dear listeners, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? The crime and violence is getting us all into a nervous breakdown. Donald Trump has his finger on the nuclear button. Syria is a disaster, and these scientists are working on such an important project. They're checking the poo of zebras for stress. The article is titled, Zebra Poo Science Improves Conservation Efforts. As far as I am concerned, I think they are talking sheer nonsense. Let's leave it there. But one more question. Just last one before the ad break. Let's see if you can answer it. It's a riddle. What comes out of a cow and sounds like a bell? What comes out of a cow and sounds like a bell? And the answer is... dung. Yes, welcome back. The program is called The Big Picture. And I had a riddle for you before the ad break. And speaking about riddles... dear people, for the past week or so, I've been drinking endless glasses of Badam Dood. What was the reason? It's because I was battling to make sense of what's happening in Saudi Arabia. And you know what? Up to now, I have failed. Failed. It's all so confusing, isn't it? It's a total mess. But as I began thinking about Saudi Arabia, it occurred to me that the mess started way back before the First World War, 1916. Here's a short history. The whole area, all the Arab lands, were under the control of the Turks. It was known as the Ottoman Empire. And so we had the war, and Britain and France on one side, and Germany and its allies, including the Ottoman Empire, on the other side. So Britain told the governor of Mecca, Sharif Hussein bin Ali, that if he helped them by staging a revolt against these Turks, against the Ottoman Empire, then the British will reward him by giving him control of all the Arab lands from Syria up in the north right down to Yemen. They will make him the new Khalif. It was, of course, a big lie. Let me quickly read to you from a report. Sharif Hussein came out in revolt against the Ottoman Empire in June 1916, recruiting a small Arab force of a few thousand men to fight in the Hijaz region, the western coastal area of Arabia containing the cities of Jeddah, Mecca and Medina, in the west that is. However, Hussein's revolt achieved only minor victories over the Ottoman army and failed to mobilize people in any part of the Arab world, despite being subsidized by the British to the tune of £11 million, which is around $400 million, multiplied that by 14 to get our rands. Following the Arab revolt in 1916, the British defeat of the Turk armies throughout the region, Hussein bin Ali, the ruler of the holy city of Mecca, proclaimed himself king of all the Arab countries, including the Hijaz in Arabia. But the British government was prepared to recognize only his control of the Hijaz. Confrontation over the future of Arabia ensued between Hussein and another British stooge, a protege, Abdulaziz ibn Saud, an emir and rising power in central Arabia, whose forces had captured the Najd region, with its capital at Riyadh. So there was the Riyadh region, and then there was the region in the west known as the Hijaz. So you got these two characters. The British officials had been split on who to champion as the leader of the revolt against the Turks. The British government of India had feared British sponsorship of an Arab Khalif. If a Khalif was in place, then maybe he will take over the whole entire Muslim world, and the effect this might have on the Muslims in India. And therefore, the British had favored Ibn Saud, who was more into limiting his control in Arabia. In contrast to Hussein's orthodox Sunnism, the future founder of Saudi Arabia sat at the head of an ultra-conservative Sunni revivalist movement known as Wahhabism, which professed a strict adherence to the tenets of Islam and which had developed in the 18th century based on the teaching of the theologian Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, born in 1703. Ibn Saud's military forces were the Ikhwani, or Brotherhood, a militia of Bedouin tribesmen instructed by religious teachers who were committed to the purification of Islam and the advancement of government based on strict Islamic law. So this is what Ibn Saud had. He had this whole group of people. And Britain had already provided arms and money to Ibn Saud during the First World War, signing a treaty with him in 1915. Anyway, I just want to jump forward a little bit. So the British supported Ibn Saud because he was more interested in Saudi Arabia and not into being a big Khalif or something. So Hussein was sidelined. At first they tried to support, there was a fight between these two guys here, this Hussein and this Ibn Saud. There was a ceasefire, and Ibn Saud's 150,000 strong Ikhwani soldiers advanced relentlessly, and by the mid-1920s had gained control of Arabia, including the Hijaz and the holy places, Makkah, Medina, Jeddah, defeating Hussein for supremacy in the region. Ibn Saud established Saudi Arabia in an orgy of murder. In his expose of the corruption of the Saudi ruling family, Sayyid Abu Rish describes Ibn Saud as a lecher and a bloodthirsty autocrat whose savagery wreaked havoc across Arabia, terrorizing and mercilessly slaughtering his enemies. The conquest of Arabia cost the lives of around 400,000 people. Since Saud's forces did not take prisoners, over a million people fled to neighboring countries. Numerous rebellions against the House of Saud subsequently took place, each put down in mass killings of mostly innocent victims, including women and children. By the mid-1920s, most of Arabia had been subdued, 40,000 people had been publicly executed, and some 350,000 had had limbs amputated. The territory was divided into districts under the control of Saud's relatives, a situation which largely prevails today. The British recognized Ibn Saud's control of Arabia, and by 1922 his subsidy was raised to £100,000 a year by Colonial Secretary Winston Churchill. Ah, there you have it. Wonderful stuff, isn't it? Muslims killing Muslims, and who is controlling the whole thing? The puppet masters, these are the outside powers. Treachery, backstabbing, double dealing, self-interest. It's all actually happening today. And we are witnessing what is described as an earthquake. And the first shock, the Saudi King Salman decided to replace the crown prince, the fellow who was due to be the next king when Salman died. And his name is Mohammed bin Nayef. He was replaced, and King Salman made his own son Mohammed bin Salman the new crown prince. And this fellow Mohammed bin Salman is young, he's about 32 years old. He immediately, by all accounts, began taking charge of Saudi Arabia. He launched a crushing war against Yemen. Thousands have died and many more are dying every day. A week ago he put into place an embargo that's so severe nothing was allowed into Yemen. Not even desperately needed humanitarian aid. The Yemenis are dying like flies. Death from malnutrition is at a crisis level. Then Mohammed bin Salman tackled Qatar. He told them to close down Al Jazeera, break ties with terrorist organizations, meaning of course Hamas, and stop dealing with Iran. Wow. Isn't that what Israel wants? But Qatar is stubbornly holding out. No giving in to these demands. Then he announced big reforms. Women will be allowed to drive, a so-called moderate Islam will be promoted, enemies, there's going to be, I think cinemas are also going to be open. And so and a very vibrant city will be established, something like Dubai. He called it all Vision 2030. What was the purpose? To get the support of the young people by being viewed as a liberal. A lot of young people in Saudi Arabia. And so they will view him as a liberal and give him support. And now the biggest earthquake of all. He knows that there are many people in Saudi Arabia, powerful people opposed to him. He has to get rid of them. And so, as you heard, he went on a campaign of arresting hundreds of prominent people, princes, ministers, top business people, ulema even, anyone and everyone who he viewed as a threat to him. Most are under lock and key at the Riyadh Ritz-Carlton Hotel. Wow, what a luxury prison that is. And it's all amazing stuff. And it all could backfire. All these prominent people come from powerful tribes in Saudi Arabia, and they will not look kindly to what Mohammed bin Salman is doing, and therefore it could erupt into some kind of uprising. The lighty is playing with fire. It could be a very dangerous miscalculation. It could backfire on him very badly. And the constantly nagging question is this: what is it all about? Is it just about a power grab? He wants to be the undisputed ruler of Saudi Arabia? Or is there more to it? Is he doing the bidding of America and Israel in order to keep a check, in check the rising power of Iran in the region, which has been the overwhelming concern of Benjamin Netanyahu? So you see a common purpose. Well, most reports are suggesting that this could be the case. Take the next big earthquake. The announcement by Prime Minister of Lebanon, Saad al-Hariri, that he is resigning. Where did he make this announcement? In Saudi Arabia, of course. Isn't that very strange? Why is Lebanon in the firing line? Because Hezbollah is the Mamoudeh. Hezbollah is buddies with Iran. Iran is buddies with Iraq. Iraq is buddies with Assad of Syria. And Hezbollah has to be targeted. And Netanyahu is not a buddy of Hezbollah. So, is Israel involved in the Lebanon shenanigans? This was reported widely in the Middle East media and also in Israel. Here is the respected journalist Jonathan Cook, what he has to say. He says here, Israel has instructed its overseas embassies to lobby their respective host countries in support of Saudi Arabia and its apparent efforts to destabilize Lebanon. A recently leaked diplomatic cable shows. The cable appears to be the first formal confirmation of rumors that Israel and Saudi Arabia are colluding to stoke tensions in the region. Sent by the Israeli Foreign Ministry and disclosed by Israel Channel 10 TV news network this week, the cable demanded that diplomats stress Iran and Hezbollah's engagement in regional subversion. That closely echoes accusations Riyadh leveled against Tehran and the Lebanese faction in recent days. Well, my response in Chinese, ah, so. Let me give you some background to the situation in Lebanon. It's such a wonderful country, absolutely beautiful. Beirut is known as the Paris of the Middle East, a cross between Durban and Cape Town. Very cosmopolitan, people jogging on the Corniche, the waterfront. Coffee shops and restaurants are buzzing. You can swim in the morning and ski in the afternoon. And you know what? I hope that there is snow on the mountains when I go there with my group. In a few weeks' time, we go to a snow resort where everyone whizzes up and down on snowmobiles and the bullies chase the aunties with snowballs and so on. Okay, back to the subject. Lebanon is always in a fragile state. Outside powers keep interfering. Syria occupied it for a long time. Americans put their finger there. Israel bombs it. And the Saudis support one section of the population. The population is made up of three broad groups. The Sunnis, the Shias, and the Christians. In order to maintain some balance, the political system is aligned so that the president is a Maronite Christian, the prime minister is a Sunni Muslim, and the speaker of the parliament is a Shia Muslim. The people all get on fine, but on the political level, there is always tension. Hezbollah has great influence and power in Lebanon and is widely respected and supported, especially because of its defensive role in protecting Lebanon against Israeli aggression. So, for about a year, there has been a reasonably stable government in Lebanon, and it's impossible to remove Hezbollah. Impossible to remove Hezbollah. So, could this latest move, the resignation of Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri, be aimed at destabilizing Lebanon? Well, all parties, even Hezbollah, which is in opposition to Hariri's party, known as the Future Party, wants him to return, and the president also wants him to return. All of Lebanon wants him to return because they fear that if he doesn't, then there will be instability, danger. Lebanon is always fragile, as I said, on thin ice because of outside interference. So that could be the aim. Capsize the political system, and this could in some way put pressure on Hezbollah. And I have, you know, I've had coffee many times with Robert Fisk in Beirut. He lives there, a really great guy, and his writings in the British Independent newspapers are very sharp, very incisive. And this week, he unpacked this whole resignation thing. I'm running out of time, so I can't read you his brilliant article, but go to the Independent, British Independent website and you'll read his article. Great analysis there. I'll have to leave it out today. So, as I said at the start, it's hard to say what's really happening. And I just came across this article about why Saudis and its allies, the Gulf states, are against Qatar. It's all about football, you see. I just got this from the well-respected news site, The Intercept. Here's the headline. It says here, if I can get it, leaked documents expose stunning plans to wage financial war on Qatar and steal the World Cup. A plan for the United Arab Emirates to wage financial war against its Gulf rival Qatar was found in the task folder of an email account belonging to UAE ambassador to the United States, Yusuf Al-Otaibah, and subsequently obtained by the Intercept website. Well, there you are, folks. Everything that's happening in the Middle East can be compared to a game of football. Saudi Arabia is offside, but is still playing. Qatar has been shown the red card, but is still in the game. Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood have been sent off, and Lebanon's got the yellow card. But you know what? In his latest move, it looks like Mohammed bin Salman Ronaldo has scored an own goal. Please pass the Badam Dude. Right. Last minute left. And let's round up with light at the end of the tunnel. And so, keeping with the theme of soccer, by the way, the next World Cup will be in Russia next year from mid-June to mid-July. And I will be there. Yes. Are you jealous? Well, actually, I'll be there just after the World Cup. And that's at the end of July, with a group to do a tour of this exciting destination, Moscow, St. Petersburg, wagera. And here's the light for today. And it's a recycled one. 9-year-old Sipo is brought before a judge. His parents are divorcing, and the judge has to decide who is going to get custody of the child. And the judge says, "Young man, do you want to go and stay with your mother?" And Sipo replies, "No, sir." And the judge says, "Why not?" And Sipo replies, "Because my mother beats me too much." And the judge says, "Okay, then do you want to go and stay with your father?" And Sipo replies, "No, sir. My father also beats me too much." And the judge says, "You don't want to stay with your mother or your father because you say they beat you? So who do you want to stay with?" And Sipo replies, "Sir, I want to stay with Bafana Bafana." And the judge says, "Bafana Bafana, why you want to stay with Bafana Bafana?" And Sipo replies, "Because, sir, Bafana Bafana beats no one." This is Abi Dawji bidding you all assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.